Hey, welcome to my show. I'm Schnoodlebug. This is a DIY podcast about making stuff no matter what. As always, this episode is brought to you by Schnoodle Video, your one-stop media shop. The following phone call with Case Esperas was recorded a couple of weeks before the Blu-ray release of his second feature film, The Absence of Milk in the Mouths of the Lost, via Vinegar Syndrome. But first, a conversation with Warren Chan, the man responsible for funding, filming, and distributing Case's film through Art Label, his new Vinegar Syndrome sublabel.
Well, it's funny, you know, my mother is a big bibliophile, and, you know, from a very young age, she was trying to get me to read, and I really enjoyed it. I read voraciously, and I remember being 4 or 5 and, like, trying to figure out with my little hand how to write, and I wanted to, you know, write my own stories. So the drive to tell stories started, you know, around that age for me, and it wasn't until high school, even though, you know, my dad was a big movie guy, and like we had a VHS collection, a sizable one for the 80s. You know, it wasn't until high school that I realized that I wanted to shift from writing for like the page to writing for the screen, and then also, you know, like everyone, I had aspirations to be a director that have not really materialized yet, but it's in the works always. But yeah, I remember being able to daydream and like give life to the weird things in my head through the words. And that was when I realized I wanted to do that. I wanted to be able to communicate the mess inside my head to other people.
Right. So was there kind of an early foray into filmmaking or any kind of experience back then?
Yeah, they're embarrassing. They're very embarrassing. I think it was 10th grade. I got a little Sony Hi8 camera that had all these neat little functions. Like there was night vision and invert and all these other things, posterize. And where it got really fun was like combining the effects with one another so you could get really strange looking footage. But I really, despite my love of storytelling, had absolutely no innate sense for it. And so it's just little bits and pieces of me and my friends goofing off. You know, there was this local legend where I grew up, which was in Kirtland, Ohio. And there was this thing called the Melon Heads. And I lived just shy of a mile down the road from this place called Wisner Road, which is this really run-down old road that ran into the woods. And the myth was that there used to be a doctor that ran a little children's hospital at the end of this road for kids with hydroencephalitis. So, like, they would get water in the brain or something and their heads would swell up, hence melon heads. But if you would walk down this road at night to the end, you were supposed to be able to hear, you know, the ghosts of the little kids running around. And so a lot of times I would take that camera with some of my friends and we would just shoot all the way walking to the end of this road and back. And of course, we never heard or saw anything, but it was fun too. Blair Witch happened around then, so right. Everyone with the camera was doing that kind of thing, myself included. But, you know, it was around that time I was discovering like early Peter Jackson stuff. I had found a rental copy of Bad Taste and that blew my mind. And, you know, I was getting into Jörg Bucherite. So Necromantic was big for me. Eraserhead was big for me. Some mainstream stuff too. Like I endlessly watched Trainspotting and Quentin Tarantino's movies and all that, but digging into the weird stuff as well as I could find it.
How did that then kind of mutate into more shot on video content and some more of the stuff that you would eventually release through Culture Shock?
I remember the first shot on video movie that really grabbed my attention was Redneck Zombies, and my best friend at the time, Mark, he and I would, after discovering that, tried to watch every trauma movie we could find, which is sometimes hit or miss, but I'll still watch any time of day, any day. I'll watch Redneck Zombies. If anyone wants to watch it, I'm down. Like, I've seen it so many times. But then, yeah, that blossomed into a greater appreciation for other shot on video fare. So that was a big part of Culture Shock releasing and remains a big part of what I do with Art Label. So I was working, doing color correction and film scanning and all of that for my day job. And, you know, I was getting to work on a lot of cool films, but, you know, a lot of well-known stuff, some obscure things as well, I suppose. But, you know, there were a lot of things that just weren't getting attention. And I don't know. I mean, were we on video, the listeners would see my collection of movies, which is pretty extensive. I just want everything to be available, you know? That's my thing. Like, you shouldn't have to resort to torrenting. Like, things should just be available. And so I think the first thing I did was under the label Verboten Video was Holy Moly, which was shot on SVHS by Lance Ozanix and his best friend, Lance from the thrash metal band Schizo. And, you know, that's something that people just aren't going to find. A lot of people aren't going to find. I mean, I did find that I had some friends who had seen it and they were really excited that I was going to put it out with special features and everything. And then Blonde Death with Bleeding Skull and Mondo at the time. Like, that stuff just, you don't find it on film. And if you do, it doesn't have the same character. Like, sneaking into Disney World to shoot like a heist scene. Like, if you did have that shot on film, it would be a very different experience. And it wouldn't feel, I don't know, as anarchic. I guess that's a word. So, yeah, I mean, there's just a level of excitement to shot on video for me. And also a degree of inspiration, because nowadays it takes so little money to make a feature. Like, you could do it on your phone. And that just opens up so many possibilities that when you have the directed by committee kind of feeling of a big budget film, that just loses that specialness.
What was the ladder of going from something like Verboten Video, Culture Shock, to having your own label through Vinegar Syndrome, like Art Label?
With Culture Shock, there were some, I would say, known quantities that we were working with. Like, we knew Girlfriend from Hell would do well. We knew that, I'm trying to think of what else we put out. We knew some titles were going to do pretty well, but then, you know, we tried to throw some lesser seen shot on video or very barely distributed shot on film stuff into the mix as well. But it was, you know, it was like consistently horror, sex comedy, you know, that kind of thing. And while I appreciate those, I watch them, I enjoy them, you know, there are a lot of groups working to put that stuff out there. And I think there are certainly fewer groups trying to get experimental and, you know, really odd art house stuff into people's hands. And so, you know, there was a fair amount of competition, if I'm being frank, for titles in the horror and exploitation realms. And there's less competition for art house films. And there's also less market, but for the people who do really like this stuff, I think they're thrilled that releases are happening.
The first three, I guess, releases in your catalog, they're very very individual, right? Like, especially the third one there, being shot on a laptop camera.
Yeah.
It's really, really something. I haven't had the pleasure of watching that one yet. It's super exciting to be able to see something archived that well and cataloged like that, you know, and I think it's a dream come true, especially, you know, like as a filmmaker myself. It's one of those things I think about all the time. Like, my ultimate goal is like a physical release of some sort, because I feel like you have it on a disc. It exists. It's not just a video file, right? So it's really inspiring just how wild these things are, and then to see them in such beautiful packages like that.
Yeah, I mean, if I'm being completely honest, part of a major driver for me to have a label like this was, you know, when I meet people like Case and I see the potential in someone like with more resources and like a bigger crew to do something really amazing, as he ended up doing with his second feature film. You know, I wanted to be able to have a hand in making some films and then having distribution lined up for that. And I mean, I am working on a feature film that's like hybrid live action animation of my own.
Nice.
That I'm really hoping to get out, gosh, I hope in a year. That's but exciting. Animation takes forever, so
I know, yeah. We'll
about that. Yeah, like I love yet. Digging up this old stuff and like just crate digging, you know, to use a record collecting term, but finding weird things. And like Culture Shock was taking up too much of my time and energy, and that's why I wanted to maybe have like a slower pace of releases, and for that I wanted to go on my own and also go in this other direction. But it also gives me a little more time to work on my own projects and the projects of friends or you know, people I meet who I really believe in, like Case.
For sure. And I'd love to get into that. How did you two meet?
He was working at the video store in town, and I was in there renting some movies, and we got to chatting, and he said that, you know, his first film was available at the store to rent. And so I rented that, and I was like watching it thinking, man, yeah, this kid has a unique vision. And so the next time I saw him when I was in there, I said, hey, are you working on anything else? Like, do you got something else that you are doing next? And he said that he had been working on this story like his whole life. A lot of it rooted in some personal experience that, you know, was very profound for him. And he told me a little bit about that. And I just knew like I had to be a part of it. And so, we wrote up an agreement, and I was like, hey, I will pay this much into the production. I just want to be able to distribute it, and I'm happy to shoot it. I've got like this video equipment that's pretty good, and it just worked out really well. It was a good pairing.
And how quickly did the production happen from that point?
Ooh, yeah. Production was kind of drawn out due to varying circumstances. Yeah, the lead actor, Gary Wilson, lived down in, I think, San Diego, mm-hmm. and the main actress in Wyoming. And there were various people in town that he had to work with, but the two main actors didn't live in town. So it was challenging, I know, to arrange that. Then I had like some problems. He had some stuff come up during the production. I think it ended up taking 2 years end to end, but I think it was worth it. You know, I think in between some of the chunks of production, different ideas came up that enriched the final product.
So once it was shot, did you have a lot of involvement in the post-production at that point, or did you just kind of let him do his thing? And
yeah, I really just handed it off, and he edited it, did some really amazing audio design, sound design, and then it's got that great original score by Aaron Dillaway. Yeah, I mean, when I finally got to see the finished film, I was really taken aback by how it came together and how haunting and mesmerizing it was.
What was it like to make a deluxe Blu-ray of something that you've actually been a part of in terms of, you know, production and cinematography and everything?
That was pretty thrilling, honestly. I did have one prior experience with that, which fourth Culture Shock releasing disc was Donald Farmer's Cannibal Hookers remake. For that, I shot a significant part of that, as well as edited, scored it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I had a lot of hats on that one, and that was really thrilling as well, especially because a little bit after we put that out, we did a 7-inch release with some pieces of the score, and that was really gratifying.
That's very cool. Were you involved in the production of that 7-inch as well?
Yes, which was actually not my first foray into pressing vinyl, because my good friend from college and I made this joke one day, like, oh, what if we took Misfits songs but like reinvented them as if they were written by like robots from outer space? And we kept joking about it, and then eventually we're like, yeah, why not do this? And so we recorded a whole LP of that, and it was something that absolutely no one asked for. But you know, we really loved doing it. We got this guy who produced records for one of our favorite musicians, a guy named Neil Zumwalt from Minnesota. We got his producer to agree to mix and master our record, and it ended up turning out way better than it should have sounded with this guy's help. He goes by the Atomic Wolf. His name's Aaron Baum, also a Minnesota guy. But yeah, we were like, we got to make this a real thing. And we did I think we did a Indiegogo. I don't think it was Kickstarter. And got a fair number of people to kick in. And so that was really great. Yeah, we pressed an EP later too, another seven. That's cool. But I mean, like, I have tons of those left. I'm never going to be without these records. But right. Sometimes when you want something bad enough, like, you got to take a loss. You just got to make it happen.
Absolutely.
I think that's a thing that a lot of us face, which is, you know, I think a lot of us have drive to create these things. And, you know, there are a handful of very common reasons that we all come up against that make us stop. And like, one is, it's not going to be good enough. One is, I can't make the time. Another is, I can't set aside the money, don't have enough money. You have to think of it not as a responsibility to yourself to have this fulfillment at the end of that journey, but you really need to think of it as a responsibility to history and to humanity. Because when you look back at like history texts about the early 1900s or 1800s or what have you, you know, you can look at a bunch of plainly stated facts, you can look at a bunch of dates, but what really gives you a sense for what it was like to be alive in that time is the art that was created then. Like, if you look at any movements in painting, like, you get such a better sense for what it was to have a heart and a brain and emotions and like be living in the events that are going on at that point in time. We need to do that now. Like, we need to express ourselves in this way so that in the future, you know, we leave a multifaceted portrait of what life was like at this point in time.
Yeah, no, that's really beautiful. And I love going back to just art label and what that represents, right? I think that's, you do a good job of exemplifying that through those releases. Just learning about those guys in the 90s, you know, in New York, a group of people doing this theater, you know, comedy stuff that I would never have known about. And had it not been for this Blu-ray that you released that had all this kind of almost this catalog of everything they've done and context for them, and then you learn so much by the third or fourth film, you almost feel like you're in on the joke and you're in the club, and it's really beautiful. It's really fascinating.
Thanks. I'm glad you enjoyed that. And that's one of those things that it's shocking to believe that there was that much material that could have easily just sunk into nothingness. And I can't even take full credit for that. Like, there was a guy, named William Wilson who brought it to my attention. And he said, look, you got to talk to Matt Mittler and save this stuff because it's insane. And I looked at the titles of those movies and I thought, oh my God, yes, absolutely. These need to be seen before I had even watched any of them. And then, fortuitously, I watched them and they were great. So
that's lucky.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, how could they not be with the,
I mean, with those names, right?
Yeah. So that was a really rewarding journey for me, and I'm glad that some other people are enjoying it as well. I'd, every once in a while, look at the reviews that are left on the Vinegar Syndrome site, and it's almost all 5 stars for that set, and for Cracking Up as well. So I think it's going to be a slow burn kind of thing, word of mouth. It didn't do amazingly opening weekend, but
right.
I think people, more and more people are going to see it and realize that there are some treasures in there.
So if you don't mind me asking, when you decide to put something out on whatever label you're working on, I guess it is kind of a gamble as to you know, is this going to do well, and is this going to lead to the success of mm-hmm. my label and have continuous releases, and what is that going to look like and stuff. So do you have a kind of ethos built into Art Label?
Yeah, I think there's a loose ethos that everything, I think, in retrospect does fit. And it's really just because with Culture Shock, it was genre based and really like Cracking Up as a comedy. And in the Surf Reality set, we have comedy, we have drama, we have horror, science fiction too. And Satyricon, how do you even categorize? I'm not even sure. But yeah, it's really, I just need to see something that is, I have to know that it's different from other things I can find elsewhere. I need to know that it's pushing the boundaries of storytelling as we know it. I think Case's film certainly does that. It can be very abstract, and it's got a very deliberate pace. Satyricon is kind of the opposite. It's very frenetic, very in your face, fast cuts, just wild, colorful, almost like flash animation kind of stuff mixed in there. Satyricon kind of seems like something you would, like the cumulative effect you would have by just staying up all night high on whatever, like looking through Reddit and, you know, something like that. You know, when I got in touch with the band, they thankfully had a lot of material already made. They're both very prolific artists, and, you know, they had a live show. They had, well, it was like a COVID era live show. It was streamed, but
right.
And then, you know, they had done music videos for every song for their first couple albums. And so there was just that wealth of material, and it's all
like 22 music videos on the disc,
something like that. I kind of forget.
Crazy.
And so, yeah, it was just this wealth of stuff, and they were just a band that, you know, I was doing color correction for Severin at the time, and, you know, my partner at the time was just surfing around Spotify or somewhere, and she said, oh my God, you have to hear this band, and played it for me, and it was just, like, immediate love. Like, I had never heard anything quite like it, and just the energy, the weird samples, I just needed all of it. And then when they made this movie, I was like, oh shit, well, there's a match made in heaven. I need to get the rights to this.
It's so cool.
And they were really surprised, I think, and pleased to work together on that. I mean, honestly, at any given point in time, I've got like 20 stories that I'm working on in my head. I've got so many, I'll never be able to do all of them for better or worse. But I mean, the best friend I alluded to earlier, who I worked with on the Misfits records, he's my main writing partner. And so we've written two scripts. We've completed a couple feature-length scripts together, some shorts. We're working on two more feature-length right now. And then I've got one that I'm working on with another partner, and then several that I'm trying to get going on my own as well. It might be an Aries thing. Like, I have a hard time finishing stuff, but I want to start everything. And so when I need a break from whatever project I'm doing at any given point in time, I need there to be something else that I can jump to like keep the fire burning. I find different people through different means. Like, I'm very much a victim of modern culture in that, you know, when I'm feeling overwhelmed by work or stuff in my personal life and I should like channel that energy into writing, I'll just fall hard into a scroll hole, and I'll just be like searching hashtags on Instagram, like video art or, you know, hashtag surrealism. And I just see what comes up. And sometimes I find really interesting work and I think, man, like, because primarily you see images, and I think this is a really interesting 2D image, and how would that translate to a linear medium? And so I'll throw darts and just reach out to people and say, hey, have you ever thought about making a feature film? Do you have any ideas that you want to work on? You know, if you had a couple thousand dollars, like what would that do for you? Like, could you make a movie? Would that make the difference? And sometimes people are receptive. Sometimes, you know, they just go to the message request folder and no one ever sees them. You know, there's an artist in Britain right now who I'm talking to, and we haven't gotten very far, but she does some really amazing work with sculpture. And I think people who are sculptors often have really interesting ideas for film and composition. Yeah, and sometimes it's just people I meet, like Case. There's another artist I met on Instagram who, I shouldn't say too much about that one, but I'm kind of working with him on a like an alternate version of a project I'm doing. You know how like chefs will do like eggs two ways or something, and the idea here is like I want to have one filmmaker take a script and shoot it one way and then give it to another and have them do it another way and then put both on one disc for the contrast for people to see how it was done differently by different minds. And another thing that I have in mind for Art Label that I haven't really fully fleshed out yet is, are you familiar with Stephen King's Dollar Babies?
Yeah.
So like, I kind of want to do something like that where, as I mentioned, I have like just tons and tons of script ideas, and I want to take some time, write them all, and then just have them up on the Art Label site where it's like, hey, you're free to adapt these to film if you want. The caveat is I'll have first right to release it for like 5 years or something. Right. But I figure I'll never be able to make all the movies in my head, but that's one way for me to like put them out in the world. And if some people see potential in it, then maybe I can see what other people do with those ideas, because it may be so radically different and better than what I would have done with it. Yeah.
Man, I love it.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, that's the exciting part for me now. It was really exciting for a long time to dig up these things, and there's still some excitement in that. I still like to trawl the deep end and see what comes up. But yeah, I want to have more hand in creating unique things from scratch.
Hey, it's Schnoodlebug. Just wanted to pop in and say thank you to my lovely listeners. I know the uploads haven't been as regular lately. That said, I have so many great conversations in the can coming your way. One way you could help me speed up the process is by supporting me on Patreon. I've added a link in the show notes should you have the means to support me financially. Otherwise, leaving a review on your podcast platform of choice is a free way to spread the word, be it Apple, Spotify, or YouTube. Okay, back to the show.
I'm a triplet. I grew up with two other brothers, and all three of us were like, just, you know, super into movies. And that's kind of just like, that's all like we did for a long time, was just like watch movies. And it wasn't until maybe I had like, we were like 8 or 9 where, you know, I mean, a lot of kids had done this, but we would take my dad's, like, he had this kind of Sony cassette camera, you know, we would watch movies on like TCM, Turner Classic Movies, or anything else, cable television. And the ones that like really sat with us and resonated with us, we would do like these like parodies, kind of these like feature length parodies of the movie, where all three of us would like act each role, and we would kind of turn them into like comedies. But yeah, things like that. So it's like our first one. We're super into the movie Psycho, the Hitchcock film.
Sounds like you had a pretty classical upbringing in terms of like your film diet.
It's probably, yeah, I wonder why. That is true. Like, it was like a lot of black and white. The Marx Brothers were super influential to us just because it was like three brothers, like, you know, plotting shenanigans and stuff. We loved the Marx Brothers. Yeah, we went as the Marx Brothers for like Halloween when we were like in third grade one time.
Oh.
yeah. I don't know. We really liked going to like Universal Studios in LA and like taking the tram tour and, you know, being like the movies and like all that stuff was like pretty romantic and all that. We were from Mandeville, Louisiana. It's kind of a small town that's like across the bridge from New Orleans, Louisiana. And I think like a lot of that stuff, like of course, like if you're not from LA or all that stuff, it gets kind of romantic, the filmmaking, because we had family who lived in California, so we would come out sometimes and we'd go to like Universal Studios and be like, oh, the movies, you know. It was totally part of our DNAs for sure. Like, we love storytelling and filmmaking.
It was, I mean, I'm still, I always like still think I'm kind of just doing the same stuff I was doing when I was 8. Like, it's the same thing.
it's always just like a DIY way to do it. I think it was like I had this skate friend in high school who recently just passed away, like a couple months ago. But he had turned me on to like a lot of like more kind of experimental kind of like films that like because we wanted to make films like super hard in high school, and he was like, you should watch this movie Gummo. And I think Gummo by Harmony Korine was kind of like this like moment where I was like you watch that film and you don't see like a budget kind of, and mm-hmm. it doesn't really, you know, it feels kind of like oh, a doable thing, and the way the plots and narratives go in that film kind of show like how it's chopped up kind of, and the way that I was thinking about making my films too, because it's like when you're working on something with such a low budget and you're looking, it's like it was a formula that worked where you could do these like kind of isolated stories because you don't need the certain people all the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think, yeah, the movie Gummo was like super, super kind of eye-opening to me when I'd seen that one for the first time.
Yeah, I saw that you went to the Agro Drift LA show at Lady yeah. Girls. How was that? Yeah.
It was tight. It was cool. I really loved the film. I could see how people, you know, might not love it, but I was super into the idea because I had just recently done, I had taken my film on tour, and I've been thinking a lot about showing films in like unconventional spaces, especially like in LA where it's like not, it's such an industry city that they don't have like a lot of theater spaces that'll show your work, like unless you want to rent out a theater for a lot of money or things like that. They don't really have those kind of spaces, but it's like, it's interesting to kind of have an idea of like a full immersion experience. And that was something I've thought about for a long time with watching a movie. So it was kind of tight to see Harmony Korine and his Edgelord crew pull something like that off. Yeah, it was totally full immersion. It was like, and the movie itself, it's like in terms of like how we were watching it, it was on this monitor, and you know, some of the monitor even had like dead LED lights, and the speakers were bad. It was like the real monitors they used just for like backgrounds at the strip club. Like they probably never actually played a movie on it before. You know what I mean? Like,
for sure.
But it was like, that was like not, it was like probably, it was more about the experience and the immersion of it all and just like wild DJ sets and bottomless alcohol.
I can't imagine what the colors bouncing off all those reflective surfaces must have looked incredible.
It was, I mean, the movie itself is like totally like hypnotizing. Like when it ended, I was shocked that it was already over. It felt like I was like 30 minutes in. It was a total trance. Yeah, but I feel, yeah, it was like totally... totally cool to see him moving somewhere back into pretty much like hardcore experimenting with his films. Cause, you know, I mean, his last film, I think he did was like The Beach Bum, and that was kind of a star studded thing. And, you know, it was, yeah. It was fun, but you know, the harmony I like is like the real kind of just owning like a pure experimentation, you know, I feel like he was back on that wave with this one.
So on that note, how many places did you take the movie to?
I took it to, I think it was like 10 cities. If I remember correctly, it was 10 cities. And then we did a couple shows, like maybe two in a couple cities. So,
wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was a road trip. I took like a milk truck across America, like a dilapidated milk truck and just hit every spot.
Where did you get the milk truck?
It was in this lot. Well, I saw it in this lot, that I had worked by, and it was this like kind of truck with these like blue clouds and this like white clouds and this blue paint, and it didn't, someone was using it as like a storage unit. They were just like putting their stuff in it. So I was like, would you be willing to sell this? And we made a deal.
Nice. Do you still have it?
No, I don't. I got rid of it after the road show. It did its purpose.
For sure.
Yeah. I mean, I just like the idea of, you know, the classic roadshow. I mean, that's how films used to, you know, show their stuff. It was like not about, it was like taking it on the road and, you know, putting it in a, bringing the actual celluloid with you. I mean, I didn't bring the celluloid with me. It wasn't shot on film, but I like that spirit. The director friend of mine, John Muchisugu, he did like Modfuck Explosion and
right,
Terminal
right.
USA. He's like
yeah.
He's a great influence to me. He talked to me about treating the film kind of like you're in a band and, you know, just taking it on tour like you're just in a band. And that's like, I always feel like I had that dream, you know, to do the whole band tour, but I was never in a band good enough to ever go on tour. So I just kind of like, I was like, well, the money, because festivals, you know, it's like they want, you know, it's like money to put your film in the festival. And I was like, well, like, you could just use that money to, you know, invest in a road show. I just thought that was more feasible and more fun.
And more fun. Exactly.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't know if I trust festivals that much. Cause it's like, there's one I really like called, you know, Cuff. It's like the Chicago Underground Film Festival.
Yeah.
I used to volunteer there when I was living in Chicago for a bit. I really respected them. Hopefully I'll try to put it in that. But other than that, it's like, I couldn't even find any festivals I'd want to put it in. King Baby, I mean, I pressed up all the DVDs myself and just handed them to people I wanted to have the film, you know.
How many did you give out?
Like 50. I think I made like 50 of them.
Nice. Okay.
Yeah. I should probably print up more soon. But yeah, I don't know. I think if I'm trying to get my name out there or do anything like that, I was like making a first film. It felt kind of like I didn't think it should be under this way that you have to pay me to see it or whatever. It's like, I'll just give you a copy or, you know, just kind of have it moving or floating through the world. That's why, you know, it's like on Letterboxd, like I just put the link in the reviews and you can watch it. Yeah. I just think for our first film, it was like, you know, I try to get people to see it.
Exactly. No, that's how I feel too. I couldn't believe when I was able to upload my movie to Instagram, like the full thing. And it just happened, and I saw it get posted. Like, I didn't even add a description because I didn't think it was going to work. And then suddenly I got this notification a half hour later that said, your post was shared. I was like, wow, I just uploaded the whole thing to Instagram. And that was really beneficial because once people
that's
are on Instagram, people really don't leave that any app like that, any social media app, to go to a video service. If they're on their phones, it's really rare. So, but I was getting a lot of people messaging me saying like, I was basically tricked into watching the movie. I clicked on it and I just started watching it. And I was like, damn,
wow.
You know, it's a new way to get eyeballs for sure. But, it totally worked.
Yeah. I think it's always like, it's cool to work with the contents of the film and how you see the film and how you want people to see it.
Absolutely.
I'm kind of such a sucker for like the whole road show and the actual theatrical experience. Like I'm totally a sucker for that. Like that was cool to do it for this film, but I knew it was already my thing. Another thing was I already knew it had distribution. Like Warren, like it was already locked for Warren to put it out before I even made it. Yeah. It was like a totally different way that most people work. You know, most people do the whole festival circuits and stuff to find distribution, you know, but yeah, I mean, I was already on a contract with Warren for him to distribute it. Before it was even made. So I was just like, well, the roadshow is just kind of a fun thing. It was almost like a little less pressure off me to find distribution, you know? That's how it happened. Yeah, he was a fan of King Baby and asked me if I was working on anything else. And I was. And I had the script for this new movie. Oh, I'm always sitting on something. But I had a script for this new movie. And I think I was like, it was a long time. I was looking for financing for it for a long time. For like a year, like pretty just shooting emails out trying to figure out how to finance it. Like, I don't know what I'm doing, really. I don't think there's really an answer to figure that stuff out anyway. I guess I could talk about it, but there was a second, I don't know, sometimes, I mean, maybe I can talk about it. But there was a second where the Sacchi brothers had seen King Baby and they were fans of it.
Very cool.
And I was going back and forth with Benny Safdie and he was interested in this new film. And then that kind of fell through. And then there was like a couple people, cause the thing was like, I was taking the King Baby DVD, just like hustling it to people I respected. And that was the only way I knew how to how to get my name kind of out there in that way. Then there's a couple, you know, I was just like, yeah, I was writing letters to different distribution companies, sending people mail, doing all that stuff. But
the budget you were looking for, was it, I mean, it's relatively small, I would imagine, in comparison to other productions that are looking for funding.
Oh, yeah, it's teeny tiny.
That way. So
it's teeny tiny. That's why I thought it could be doable, you know, because there wasn't a lot of risk.
Right.
And the thing is, I was super close. I was pretty close to just making the film with just my back, just the money I had. And I would have shot it on a Canon, and it would have been just way more low quality than it ended up being. But I still would have made it for sure. But I'm lucky that I was able to make it a little pop a little more for sure. Yeah, Warren was like the producer of the film.
Right, yeah, of course. Yeah. Okay. And also the cinematographer.
Perfect. And the distributor. Well, what I mean, I'm saying he was like the total backbone of this. It was amazing. It was like super cool.
Incredible.
He was like a fan of King Baby and was just totally believed in me. It was tight. It was really awesome. I'm super stoked on that happening. I was shot on a Blackmagic, which was crazy. Like, Warren also has, like, equipment. Like, he had a Blackmagic and, like, a monitor, which was so, like, I was able to have a monitor, which I never had before, you know, so I could frame the shots really, really well, and all that stuff was super fun.
How long did it take to shoot?
Let's see. It was, like, the whole process was like a 3-year process, but the shoot was probably like a year on and off. Yeah. But it was like, you know, super, it was like you go really hard for like 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wouldn't shoot anything for a couple months and have to like, you know, save up some money. I mean, it's like, I also like, you know, I also helped fund the film. So it's like, I would have to save up money again. And yeah. So Hannah, the lead in it, Hannah Weir, she plays Maria. She came out and stayed with me for like 2 weeks. And then a lot of like the demon stuff you see on the, and the missing kid stuff, like all that was shot in like a day. Cause it's like all about like location, you know, it's like, you have a certain allotted time on a location. And you have to get as much as you can. Cause if the sun goes down, it clocks in another day. That's like another $1,000 that you just can't afford.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like you have to get it all. That's why it's like I tell a lot of people, like, location. So when you're looking for your locations, make sure you can get as much out of them as you can, because it'll save you a lot.
I wanted to ask you about some of the cast members of your project, because mm-hmm. you've worked with some very cool people. You know, for example, you have Gary Wilson in your latest movie.
Yeah.
You know, you worked with Superstar and Star on King Baby.
Oh, yeah.
You made that music video for David Liebehart. So I guess my question is, like, what
all
is your
outsider legend?
Yeah, exactly. So are you reaching out to these guys?
Yeah. I mean, each one is a different story. All of it mainly just comes from me being a fan. Yeah. So I guess for Superstar and Star, Superstar was, I was writing the film and he was someone that I got turned on to. He did the show in like Brooklyn or something. I was in New York or something, and he did a show under this Ferris wheel. And I just thought he was so like, you know, he's like, he's incredible. Like, he's such a performer. And then I found like his YouTube channel, and, you know, he was uploading all his YouTube videos, like using like security cameras that he would film the videos on. And it was so out there, and the music was so beautiful. And it kind of just, with each person that ends up in my films, it's always kind of like, it just feels like a merge of how I'm feeling at the time and what I'm writing. And, you know, I think a lot about the casting, and it was just kind of something that fit. It was like someone who was just like still powering through, and like he didn't let anyone kind of stop him in his quest for his music to get out. And the King Baby movie was kind of a retelling of Jesus Christ, and it was kind of more of a dilapidated kind of world that I felt like kind of superstar fit into. And then I found out he was super Christian, and he was like almost like this. He was kind of seeing himself as like godlike and this healer. And then I was just like, well, like that's perfect, kind of. And you know, just seeing how he performs in his videos and on stage is also part of it. And I was like, well, if he performs that well, like maybe he'll perform great on camera, like in a movie. And in his YouTube descriptions, his cell phone number's just in it. So it wasn't even like, I just called him on a whim and asked if he wanted to do it, because I was a big fan. And he was, yeah, and I just flew him out. And I just flew him out from Nebraska.
Oh, wow.
And we did it.
So cool.
Yeah. Yeah, and then I did, like, while he was in town, we also did, like, a superstar show at Debulon, where he was, like, the headliner. It was such a fun night. And, like, you know, like, he's so beloved here.
So cool. So then how did the lead
work? That one was just because this guy named Jonah, who's David Lieberhart's manager, who I've never met in person, but David Lieberhart, he did this record called, I think it's called the record the Monty Melvin song came on, like The Wonderful World of Pigs, Clowns, and Dolly Parton, I think that's the name of the record. He wanted to do like a visual album with that album, kind of like Beyonce did for Lemonade, I think that's something like that. That was like the pitch to me. So like every song on the record was going to get a music video. So he had put up he was looking for filmmakers to do the videos. And then Jonah was also a fan of King Baby and thought, you know, because I was also in LA and David Lieberhart lives here too, that it would work, which was also just something that was totally kind of came out of the blue, because I had been working at a video shop that David Lieberhart would come into a lot. And I didn't know who he was. I had never seen the Tim and Eric show or anything like that. And, I was just a fan of him as a person. He'd like come into the video store and I'd be like, this guy's like such a nut. Like, he was making me laugh so hard. He would like come in with these like gloves on, and he would like put hand sanitizer over the rubber gloves, and you know, like I was just like, whoa, like. And then he's like, and then he had these resumes that he would make and that he would hand out, but his resumes were all these like hand drawn things with pictures of him as like clowns, and it was just totally out there. So just as like a person, I was like a fan. I didn't know anything about his Adult Swim connections. I didn't know anything about it.
Wow.
Until someone was like the guy that you like is looking for filmmakers to do a video for one of his songs. Like, you should do it. I was like, perfect. Yeah. And then they sent me the Monty Melvin song, and I was like, yo, this is like, the song is like really good. Yeah, it was like an Old Dirty Bastard kind of song, you know. I was like, so yeah, it was just super. And I'm pretty picky. That's the only music video I've done. I feel like pretty picky on them, but like I hadn't even thought about doing them. But I was just like, you know, like that song went so hard, and David's so great. So yeah, Gary dates back further than most people. I was like hardcore fan of Gary Wilson. Like when I was like since I was in high school, you know. I used to throw like, you know, backyard kind of parties and things like that. And so I'd book Gary for shows because we just kind of have a history. I met him in Chicago just because I was a fan. So I went to go see his show and he was hanging around. So I got the chance to talk to him and tell him how much I was a fan of him. And I was working on a short film at the time. It'll show up as a featurette on the Blu-ray of Absence of Milk. But I was wondering if Gary could score that. I was like, would you be down to like score this film that I was working on? I didn't really think he'd actually do it. He gave me his email, and then I sent him over the short film, and then he sent me over back a score, and I was like, whoa, like, for me at the time, I was like, I can't believe like my hero just did that. You know, he was like seriously one of my heroes. Then we just had a relationship since then, and I never thought about asking him to star in a film at the time. I really didn't think about that. And yeah, I'd book him for backyard shows. So I'd see him. I'd pretty much be at every Gary Wilson show when he would come to LA. I was probably at most of them. And yeah. And then eventually I was like writing the film and the part. And just kind of just he and Gary Wilson's art and his aesthetic and his vision for his work kind of just embodied what I was thinking of for the Milkman and all that. And, you know, I think it's kind of a push and pull thing with, you know, it's a collab and I'm just, I try to cast like these people. So it's like Superstar or David Lieberhart or Gary. It's like, they're just kind of extensions in my movies. They're just extensions of who they are. And I'm casting them based, I'm just kind of doing a more exaggerated version of them. But that's just kind of the stuff that they represent to me and their work and what they're putting out.
I love that.
Yeah. I don't, you know, it's like, they're basically just playing themselves, just like more of like a spiritual version of themselves. I mean, these are just the people you're seeing that it ends up working out with.
Oh, for sure.
Like,
I get that.
You know, I have been every outsider kind of artist or like, I have just like, you know, it's like, there's weirdly some connection that with me in the past, and like, it, you know, it's not every it's been pretty great. Like a lot of the people I've tried to work with and all the casting stuff is like, it's almost become so crazy that they're almost more like interesting than the movie themselves. Like the way that it's like the way I'm living it and the way I'm, you know, like trying to get a lot of this stuff done. I guess I'm kind of attracted to more of the outsider people than the people who kind of have the spirit to just kind of keep going, and you know, all those
for
guys
sure.
who totally embody that. Like Gary, David, and like they totally and they're still making music. They're all like they're like forever for like years and years and years, and they're still just like going at it, and they never give up, and they're all like, you know, just big heroes to me for sure.
The score for Absence in particular is really beautiful.
When I looked it up,
I saw that it's Aaron Dillaway from Wolf Eyes. I was pretty floored by that. How did that happen?
Aaron made this record called The Gag File in like 2017, and the cover of that record was like this kind of weird looking ventriloquist dummy. And I bought that record at this record store called Pooba Records, and I was just super like, I literally bought it on a whim, just looking at the album cover. It felt kind of akin to the short films I was making at the time, and I felt kind of like, I was like, whoa, like, there's something about it that, especially because, like, in King Baby, there's, like, these ventriloquist dummies that appear. I felt, like, attracted to the album cover, put the record on, and was totally, like, it was, like, just, like, mind-blowing, you know? It was totally, I mean, I love noise. I'm, like, you know, I've been kind of a part of the noise scene for a while and made music. And Aaron Dillaway, of course, is like, you know, he's huge. And he's a huge icon in that world. And, but his music was like, it wasn't like as punishing or as like, you know, as harsh. It was like composed and it felt innocent kind of and childlike. And it was like this warped kind of childlike music, and it just, the music completely clicked with me, his music, and totally felt akin to the films I was making. And I just asked him, I just said one time I interviewed him on a podcast about his favorite movies and just about movies in general. And then he kind of was just like, hey, if you know, he's like, you know, I've been thinking about, I want to score a movie lately. And you know, if you think about anyone or, you know, anyone that's looking for a score, let me know. He's like just a huge cinephile guy. And so I kind of, that was before the film was shot, I kind of just put that in the back, my back pocket. And by the time the film had ended, I was like, I'll reach back and see if he's still down to do that.
So cool. The results are...
Yeah, but I think, yeah, it's funny. It's like a lot of people are like, how did you get these people? How did you get these people? But at the end of the day, it's just like, I just asked them. It's just like, I just asked. I'm a huge fan of music, and I just ask. It's like I'm not going through anything else.
No, that's a huge. I think that a lot of people don't think that's possible. That's something
totally.
I mean, that's how this podcast exists, right? Is just reaching out to people on Instagram or Twitter, and
totally, yeah,
have a conversation. And you know, I've done that in other parts of my life, and it's led to jobs, you know, or
absolutely, yeah,
right?
You just gotta ask.
I think a lot of you just gotta ask. How does it feel now to have your Blu-ray on Vinegar Syndrome?
That's nuts. That's amazing. I mean, I'm a huge fan of Vinegar Syndrome. Well, yeah, so Warren was working for Culture Shock Releasing at the time, which was a partner label of Vinegar Syndrome. So for a while, I was just like, I knew Warren wanted to put it out. I didn't know any of the behind the scenes of the label stuff. I was just like, more like, he's like, here, like, I'll help make this movie and help fund it for you if I can put it out on my label. I just didn't really know about the partner labels of Vinegar Syndrome or anything like that. I think it all just timed well in terms of the fact that I was finishing up the movie and he was moving on from Culture Shock Releasing and wanting to start Art Label. And Art Label felt way more akin, and it felt more akin to the things he liked, because I've been through his library collection and I know the stuff that he's into. And Culture Shock Releasing seemed like it was more like old slasher films and stuff. And I was like, well, and the whole time I was thinking, well, I was like, I don't know if Absence will even fit really on this partner label or on Culture Shock. It would kind of be this weird outlier. And then he, you know, talked about starting Art Label, and he's like, which felt way more akin to the things that make him happy. More weirdo kind of art stuff, experimental stuff. It's funny, I actually watched this interview with Warren that someone had done with him a couple days ago, and he talked about this. He was at this Mike Kuchar screening that time, and then when he mentioned that, I was like, oh my gosh, I was at that one too. That's so crazy. But at the time, we didn't know each other, but it's cool because I was like, oh, okay, I think the both of us are kind of into the same kind of weirdo, kind of underground stuff. So, you know, as he was putting out Art Label, it was like we already had a new film for it. So that was great. I mean, I don't know anything about the behind the scenes of all that. You know, that's what he feels. But like, to have like more than 50 copies of my movie and then actually have it on a label is totally exciting for me. It's great. I sat down. I mean, Warren, you know, like he, you know, we sat down together and helped design the cover and all that. And
yeah, I love the package design is awesome. Really well done.
Yeah, it's a scan of one of the slip cover is a scan of one of the milk cartons that shows up in the film, but it was like a vintage milk carton I found on like Etsy. So we scanned that and kind of altered it a bit.
What was it like making the Blu-ray content and everything like that? Did you sit down with Warren and kind of figure out a plan for what you wanted to put on the disc?
No, it's kind of funny. It was like totally, that was like, it was kind of just on my own. I don't know. I think it was like, yeah, it was kind of on its own. I kind of knew it was the thing that like, I didn't really know what label it was going to go on, but I knew it was hopefully going to get distributed. So there was these like little moments where like, I think a lot of the features I also think came from regret of not recording a lot of stuff behind the scenes on King Baby. So when this film started production, I was like, I wanted people to be there kind of documenting some stuff. So there's enough stuff to put out. There's enough stuff to have some features. And then when it was like, then when Warren let me know that he's like, oh, we need to get the features in by November, I was like, okay, well, I could use what we've already collected and try to, you know,
right,
get some stuff for sure. Yeah, I mean, I really regretted not filming a lot of the Q&As on the road show. That was a huge regret. I don't know why I didn't do that. But it was like, so it's like if I did like a Q&A at the, I did one at like the University of Central Florida. And then I was like, you know, this is timing great because this is like with the deadline, I need to get some features in. Would you guys mind if I recorded this? And then they let me do it. So it was like things like that. Once I knew the deadline, it was like, okay, like, you know.
Okay, that's cool.
Special features out for sure.
You can purchase The Absence of Milk in the Mouths of the Lost, as well as the rest of the Art Label catalog, through the links in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening to The Schnoodlebug Show. Spread the word, tell your friends, and go make stuff.